You're listening to Return to the Source. Just heard a couple selections from pianist Billy Childs and his latest recording. It's on Mac Avenue Records, the Grammy Award-winning recording called Rebirth. We just heard the composition Stay, and we started out with the title track, one called Rebirth. And I'm joined now by pianist, composer, arranger Billy Childs. He's a native of Los Angeles, California, graduated from USC with a degree in composition. He made his recording debut with J.J. Johnson, and while he was still at USC, he joined the band of Freddie Hubbard for a six-year period, in fact, making several recordings with Freddie. He also would lead a group called Night Flight, which included Diane Reeves. In 1988, he began his recording career as a leader for Windham Hill Records. In fact, we heard some of that music earlier in the evening. And in 1992, he began writing commission works for symphonies, and his 1995 recording, I've Known Rivers, was on the Stretch GRP label, and his 1996 recording called The Child Within, which we heard some music from that as well. Of course, he's a multiple Grammy Award winner, and his recording, as we said, Rebirth, won the 2018 Grammy for Best Jazz Instrumental Album. In 2000, he arranged, orchestrated, and conducted the Grammy Award-winning recording by Diane Reeves called The Calling, celebrating Sarah Vaughan. And he's also arranged for people like Sting, Yo-Yo Ma, Chris Botti, and others. He also won the 2015 Grammy for Best Arrangement in the Instrument and Vocals for his recording Map to the Treasure, Reimagining Lord Nero. He's also won Grammys for his Jazz Chamber recordings. And in 2009, Childs was the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. And in 2013, he was awarded a Doris Duke Performing Artist Award. And we'll talk about all of this and much more. And Billy Childs, welcome to Return to the Source and WJAB.
Wow. Thank you.
All right.
And thanks for reading the whole thing.
I mean, I left a whole lot out, man, but I just wanted to give people a flavor of sort of what you've done. But let's begin, Billy, with some of your earliest influences. You know, I know you're from L.A., and I'm from I'm from Pasadena, California.
Oh, really?
And I'm probably a little bit older than you, but who were some of your earliest influence in terms of music, man?
Wow, it's really refreshing to hear and talk to someone who's even older than I am. Because I used to be on the other end of that statement, but now it's like I'm looking at people younger.
Yeah.
I guess the main influence that I had at a young age was Herbie Hancock.
Okay.
And frankly, I don't see, you know, it's like kind of like Bud Powell. It's like if you're of a certain era, I don't really think you can call yourself a jazz pianist and not have checked out Herbie Hancock.
That's right.
You know, and you know, it's just like pianists from his era had to go through Bud Powell and Art Tatum, you know, and I think, you know, Herbie Hancock from my generation, Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett, McCoy Tyner, Bill Evans, you know.
Yeah.
There are certain pianists that are just kind of define the idiom, and you really have to check out if you want to know this language. So Herbie was an influence of mine. And also Keith Emerson, of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Okay.
That was a big influence. That's actually the catalyst. He was the catalyst that made me want to play piano, seriously. So those were kind of early influences.
Well, you know,
Laura Nero was a big influence also.
I played a selection from your recording, Portrait of a Player. In fact, your composition, Tommy Flanagan. Was he a big influence on you?
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
He would come to L.A. occasionally and play in this, you know, in these clubs, and I just loved his playing, you know, and I wanted to emulate it. I'll say he wasn't an influence in my development as a pianist, but later on, after I had begun playing professionally and I started checking out even more people, I started really getting into him and, you know, Hank Jones and those Monty Alexander.
Yeah. And I'm sure Cedar Walton too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, as I mentioned to you, Billy, and once again, I'm talking with Billy Childs, I mentioned to you, I'm from Pasadena, and, you know, growing up in Pasadena, we used to hear about these musicians in L.A., and I was just wondering if you were influenced by any of these musicians. I know they're a little bit older than you, but like Patrice Rushen and Ndugu, did you play with them a lot?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And actually, when you say a little bit older, that's accurate. She's literally a little bit older, like a year or something.
Okay.
But no, I would listen to her and admire from afar, especially in the mid to late 70s,
yeah.
You know, when she was just coming out
yeah.
there. I was totally blown away by her.
Well, I remember seeing her when she was still in high school. She, you know, and she came and played with a band in Pasadena, and you know, it was this little teeny girl got up on the piano. She was wearing this African robe with an African headdress, mm-hmm. and I thought McCoy had sat down, man.
I know. It was amazing, and she was influenced by Herbie a lot too.
Okay.
She and I are really good friends now. We were then, you know, but I didn't really know her because she was really famous and I was just kind of like making my way, finding my way.
Yeah.
And Ndugu I didn't get to play with until maybe in the late 80s.
Okay.
But during the 70s, you know, they were, I kind of took a different path to arrive at where I've arrived than they did.
Okay.
You know, they kind of there was a group of musicians that they were a part of and I wasn't a part of. I was, you know, so we made our own group, like Diane Reeves and I,
yeah.
Joey Heredia and Larry Klein, and you know, we had our own, you know, circle of people, and it was not on the same profile level as that group of
okay.
people.
Okay. Now what about Azar Lawrence and Woody Theus? Do you know drummer Woody Theus? I wondered about him. What is he doing?
Sonship,
yeah.
He passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Actually, yeah, he had a kidney disorder. And he was on dialysis for a long time.
Okay.
And you know, Cameron Graves, the
yeah.
pianist.
Yeah.
You know, he had his album that came out on Mac Avenue was inspired a lot by the Urantia book. And the first time I heard about that book was through Sonship, through Woody Theus.
Okay.
And I don't really know. It's a religious belief system that I'm not really aware of and can't comment intelligently on.
Okay.
But I remember he was really into it.
Yeah, yeah.
The first time I saw Sonship, he was playing with Donald Byrd in Royce Hall, and he had his voice going through an echoplex, so he was talking. He was playing the drums and then like kind of talking, and then he would manipulate the echoplex and it sounded like an alien.
Uh-huh.
And his hair was gray. He colored his hair gray and had these little stars in them. And I thought from the perspective I was looking at in the audience, he looked like he was like about like 70 years old.
Yeah.
Because he had this gray hair until I went up and saw this youthful face with this gray hair.
He was always an interesting guy, though, man.
Yeah.
Well, another musician I want to ask you about, Billy, and in fact, when, as I said, we, you know, before we came on, I played some music from your earlier recordings on Windham Hill, and one of the musicians who were on, I think, all three of your recordings on Windham Hill, or maybe more than that, of course, is bassist Tony Dumas. I met Tony when he was still in high school in Pasadena at John Muir High School, and I'm just wondering about Tony. How's Tony doing? What's he doing, man?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I occasionally talk to him you know, once every like 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Or and he and I were very tight, you know. He was best man at my wedding.
Yeah, okay.
But we kind of parted ways for no real reason, you know, just kind of grew apart.
Yeah.
And he was like, he's like an unsung L.A. treasure.
Oh, yeah, bass. Definitely, definitely.
He's one of the best bass players I've ever played with.
You know, because I was trying to, in fact, I wanted to interview Tony, and I was trying to track him down, and, you know, somebody reached out to some of his people on Facebook, and he wasn't interested in it. So, but I've always liked the way he played. As I said, you know, I've known him since high school. I know he's been on some recent recordings by Kenny Burrell, but I haven't really heard a lot about him.
Yeah, he played with me on my first J.J. Johnson album.
Okay.
I recommended him for that.
Okay. Now tell me about the Night Flight group with Diane Reeves, man. Tell me a little bit about that group.
Well, that was a group. It originally started with me, Larry Klein, and Diane, and sometimes Joe Carrero would play, the guy who used to play with Al Jarreau.
Yeah.
And sometimes Joey Heredia would play. And then we started playing. There was a little club in Venice Beach called the Comeback Inn. And we would play there. And the group that I put together for that particular gig, the first gig that we played there was, Larry couldn't do it, so it was this incredible genius bass player named Billy Carroll, who unfortunately left us a few years ago. Joey Heredia on drums, Nick Kirgo on guitar, me on keyboards, Diane singing, and Anthony Marinelli, a friend of mine, who played synths also on keyboards too. And so but it started out without Anthony, actually, on the first gig. It was the five of us. And it was so successful that they had us come back every Saturday. We played open-ended, like, every Saturday. And it kind of took off from there.
Yeah. Well, tell me, and once again, I'm talking with pianist composer Billy Childs. And Billy, tell me about your time with Freddie Hubbard, man. I know that had to be, like, an important part of your development.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I got the gig with Freddie because Larry Klein recommended me for the gig. And Freddie had done a couple of albums like Windjammer and I forget the other ones, but real, like, obvious attempts at being commercial.
Yeah, I remember those.
You know? In the same way that, like, say, Herbie was being commercial,
yeah,
you know, with Manchild and Secrets and, you know, Sound System and Sheets Don't Fail Me Now and all of that.
In fact, I even saw Freddie during that period sing a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. I was fortunate you spared that. But, so, he was doing that, and he had a band for that. But then he put out Super Blue.
Yeah.
And with Kenny Barron and Jack DeJohnette, Ron Carter, and Joe Henderson, I think.
I think Hubie Laws was on there, too.
Hubie Laws, yeah. And it was a visit back to straight-ahead playing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he put a band together that was straight-ahead. And the band that he put together, he wanted to keep the bass player that he had in his electric band, Larry Klein, but he wanted a new, like, whole other members. So Larry suggested me, because Larry and I were really tight at the time. And Carl Burnett played, and Hadley Kellerman. And so we started touring, and I was green. I was still going to school.
Yeah.
And it taught me everything about, I mean, I knew how, I think I was still even taking jazz piano lessons at the time. But it taught me how to, you know, play with taste and with logic and, you know, in the moment, be in the moment.
Yeah.
And with a person like Freddie Hubbard that you're comping every night, there's only, you can't get worse. You can only get better.
Yeah, and I thought Freddie was, you know, in my opinion, maybe the greatest trumpet player. I mean, there was nothing he couldn't play.
Well, that's, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I think he's, if not the greatest trumpet player, certainly one of the five greatest trumpet players ever to play jazz.
Yeah.
you know, I'll just take that one to my grave, you know, because I heard stuff coming out of the trumpet when he played that shouldn't come out of a trumpet. You know?
You mean good stuff, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It should have come out of a piano or, you know, a saxophone.
Yeah. And the way, you know, he just, and the way he played with such strength every time, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah.
Sometimes when I would get lost, I would look to him for the time when he was solo. You know, he had a perfect sense of time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Tell me, Billy, about your time with Wyndham Hill. As you know, your earlier recordings were on Wyndham Hill, and is that what got you interested in chamber jazz, or were you already interested in that? Because I know that was kind of something that Wyndham Hill kind of specialized in. Did that kind of pave the way for you to start, you know, performing in chamber jazz?
That's actually a very good question, because when I joined Wyndham Hill, I got the deal because I put out an album by myself. And on this album was like a lot of intricate compositions, right? Side A was like kind of five completely varied compositions. One was like kind of a pop song. One was like a jazz trio thing with brushes, and another thing was like a fusion thing with electric guitar, and, you know, another one was a Pat Metheny sounding thing. So it was all over the map, right? And side B was like just consisted of two long through composed compositions, no improvisation, just orchestral writing with rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
One piece was called Lunacy, and the other one was The Coming of Spring with Diane Reed singing. So I sent that out to record labels, and nobody responded except for one. And it was this guy, Andy Norell.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Who always liked my stuff. And he had a production company. He wanted to produce me, but he didn't want to do the stuff on side B, which was like the extended composition. He wanted to do the short but intricate jazz compositions,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I said, okay. So he had his production deal through Wyndham Hill. And so we did four albums with Wyndham Hill. And what started happening was that I started composing and thinking about the group, not like a typical jazz group, but more like a chamber group,
mm-hmm.
you know, like with a string quartet. Like, I wrote stuff that was intricate like it would have been for a string quartet or a wind quintet, but it was like piano, bass, drums, and saxophone. And fortunately, I had these amazing musicians, I mean, who could play this stuff and could still swing and could still, you know, solo, and it had dead-on accuracy. You know, Michael Baker, Tony Dumas, Jimmy Johnson,
yeah.
Bob Shepherd. You know, all these people are extraordinary musicians. And, you know, I just took it for granted that this was the level I should expect. I didn't realize how extraordinary these people were.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I would write something crazy and just expect that it would be played. You know? And they would.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, but it started this whole idea of writing for a jazz group as though it were a classical group,
yeah.
you know?
Okay.
A classical chamber group. And so that kind of morphed into my jazz chamber music.
Okay. Okay. And of course, speaking of composing, you know, you've composed works for the Detroit Symphony, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, the American Brass Quintet, the Dorian Wynne Quartet, and of course, you've also won a Chamber Music American Composers Grant as well. So composing, I think, it probably is just as important to you as playing, right?
Yeah, for sure. And it's actually more of a bread and butter money generator than playing.
Okay.
Is.
Okay. It's good to get those commissions, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well,
sure.
As I mentioned when I introduced you, Billy, of course, you won numerous Grammy Awards. What has that meant to your career? Is being a multiple Grammy Award winner, has that helped your career? Has it made no difference?
Well, tell me. I think it, you know, in the short term, if you're looking at it for immediate results, it's not gonna do that.
Yeah.
You know, especially a Grammy in a jazz category or a composing category or arranging or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not gonna do that, but you know, if you keep at it, if you know, since I have kept at it, and have been lucky enough to be, you know, been able to, you know, win multiple Grammys, I think the cumulative effect kind of helps your career in the sense that you become more, like, people take you more seriously you know, especially with the Grammys. You know, the Guggenheim, which is also very prestigious.
Yes, it is, yeah.
But it's not as it's a little more under the radar than the Grammys are, you know. So the and if you say a Grammy, they're like, oh. You know? But if you say a Guggenheim, you know, that might mean that you just, you know, got a loan from a bank or something, you know.
Yeah, I understand. And it's kind of like, you know, I asked an author, in fact, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author one time about this, and he said, well, I asked him, you know, what was the impact of winning the Pulitzer? He said, well, you know, when I die, they'll say Pulitzer Prize winner, you know, died. So,
Right.
You know, so I guess in that sense, it does mean something.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm very proud of, you know, the Guggenheim, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Doris Duke.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of stuff is very, you know, it's, you can feel venerated, kind of, but the Grammy, when you say Grammy, it, you know, like if you win a Drama Desk Award, you know, or you win an Oscar, I mean, it's like the difference between the two. The Drama Desk is probably, you know, much more like, I don't know, for inner circle type thing, you know, like a Pulitzer or something.
Yeah.
But the thing that rings on people's lips is the Grammy.
Yeah.
So it helps in the sense that people look at you differently, but they look at you with more like, oh, I have to take what he says or what he's doing.
Yeah, because he won a Grammy.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of like, you know,
must be good.
In fact, Billy, I'm a college professor, and you know, it's funny. I always kind of say this, too. It's like if you mention a study done at Harvard University, it you know, everybody pays attention to that because, oh, it came from Harvard, you know.
Speaking
of winning the Grammy, tell me about your Lord Nero project. You know, I'm sure there were people who were surprised that you would, you know, pick Lord Nero to do this, but I've always liked Lord Nero. Tell me a little bit about that project.
Well, Lord Nero, like I said at the beginning, was a big influence on me, and I learned about Lord Nero through my older sister, Kirsten, who was, you know, a huge Lord Nero fan. And I would just listen to her records. The music would kind of shift through the door, and I would listen to it. And I would learn her stuff was, you know, simple enough for me to learn by ear on the piano, but complex enough to where I could really get a sense of architecture and drama you know, in her writing, and I could see the logic of it,
yeah.
And it was beautiful. And so I wanted to do an album. I noticed that people were doing albums of, like, especially singer-songwriters of that generation, people would do covers of their stuff, like Joni Mitchell,
yeah.
You know, and Paul Simon. There was an album by Paul Desmond called Bridge Over Troubled Water, which had a lot of Simon and Garfunkel tunes that he covered with Don Sebesky arranging. Beautiful album. And then Herbie's album, obviously, the Joni letter.
Yeah.
But nobody really seriously did a study of Laura Nyro. And I thought that was strange, you know. And I had this idea for, like, literally about 12 years. And I was like, man, I would like to do an album of her stuff. But the problem with it was, the challenge of it was that her stuff is so unique, especially her own renditions of her music, because she wrote songs in the fifth dimension, would cover them, and
yeah.
Barbra Streisand and Three Dog Night or Blood, Sweat, and Tears. But her own versions were so unique and so idiomatic of her, and they were like different genres just blended into everything.
Yeah.
That it was like, how do I recreate this with any kind of, like, authenticity or respect to where it sounds genuine, you know, without losing any of the character of the song?
Yeah.
So I thought maybe I'll do, like, an instrumental version, but then her stuff is so married to her lyric that wasn't going to be successful. So I said, well, then maybe I'll have a singer sing it. But then I knew if I had a singular singer, sing her songs, she would invariably be compared to Laura.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nobody who does Laura like Laura. So I said, well, the only way to do this would be to have multiple singers, like a singer for each song. But that's too complicated for me to even begin to try and put together. So I just sat on it for like about 10, 12 years until the idea just wouldn't go away. So I called my manager and I said, we got to do something about this. I got to do this album. So he made some calls. I made some calls. He connected with a guy named Chuck Mitchell, who used to run Verve Records. Well, Chuck ran Verve Records, and Laura actually herself, during the end of her life, toward the end of her life, approached Chuck about doing an album on Verve, and Chuck passed. And then she passed away, and Chuck always felt regret for that. So now, when Miles, my manager, approached him, he immediately jumped at the idea, you know, and he was like heading a label called E1, Entertainment One.
Okay.
But then we didn't hear from him forever, and Miles started getting worried. And so he ran into Chuck one day and said, so what's going on with this? You know, we're doing this. And Chuck said, you know, I there's something on the table, but I can't talk about it right now. And the next thing we knew, he's head of Sony Masterworks. And this is like project number one that he wants to do.
Okay.
So the stars kind of aligned for this. And the budget became much bigger. And I got Larry Klein, my old friend from Freddie, who produced, by the way, the Joni letter for Herbie. I got him to produce. And we worked on it, we collaborated on it, and it turned out like it did.
Well, tell me this, Billy, and I meant to ask you this when we're talking about the Grammys. So do you keep your Grammys out in the open, you know, in the house, or do you hide them away? What do you do, man?
I moved, so they're in storage right now.
Okay, all right. Now, tell me about the, you know, you've been playing or you played with trumpeter Chris Botti. Tell me how that came about, and what was that like, man?
Well, it came about through Bobby Columbia, who actually is another Laura Nyro connection. He knew Laura, actually, and Bobby started Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Okay.
So he was the drummer in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He was the producer of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And he also manages Chris Botti, and, you know, kind of was instrumental in engineering Chris's career to the stratosphere like it is now.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a friend of mine, you know, and he introduced me and Chris. I was doing an arranging job for an album that he was producing for a guy named Gary Lamell, and Chris was a trumpet player on it. And, you know, Chris was also working on an album, and Bobby said, you got to hook up with Childs, you know, and get him to write songs with you. So I wrote a few songs with Chris. And Chris liked my playing, and then asked me to join the band maybe a couple years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it was, you know, it was a wild ride. Did it for like about 6-7 years.
Okay. And so did you play in bigger arenas or something with Chris Bodio?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Carnegie Hall, you know, stadiums, and we played one stadium in Korea, you know. We played everywhere you could think of to play.
Yeah.
We played.
Yeah.
Big, small, whatever.
Okay. Now, I mentioned, of course, also that, and you mentioned, of course, going to USC. And
right.
tell you know, what is your opinion about jazz education and the sort of proliferation now of all of these jazz programs? In fact, I mentioned this because I saw you in 1999 at the IAJE conference in California.
With Steve Wilson and Mitty Smith and Bob Hurst.
Do you see the proliferation of all these programs? Is that a good thing?
Well, I mean, you know, good or bad, it just is, you know. It's, you know, jazz has definitely moved from the streets and into the academic world.
Yeah.
I mean, that the academic places are the places where the most, like, the most talented youth that is interested in jazz, that's where they go.
Uh-huh.
They don't... You don't go to, in my day, you don't, if you're talented and you play jazz, you don't go to New York and start playing clubs like you did in my day, you know. Or even here, you know, I made a good living and a good career playing clubs here, you know, and making your own way. And there were a lot of gigs to be had, you know. Now you go to school and you learn in a methodical kind of, like, focused way how to play jazz. You know, and a lot of times kids, you know, go to YouTube and just go directly to the thing that they want to learn and just get that.
Yeah.
And sometimes that leaves out, as Ndugu said, you know, in a video, sometimes that leaves out how the person that they're focused on got to where he got or she got.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of an unfortunate thing. And since there's YouTube and, you know, kind of this permeating ethos of technology in the music, it kind of has canceled out the kind of mentor-apprentice paradigm that was happening when I was growing up. Like, I learned from Freddie Hubbard, but not just Freddie Hubbard. I learned from people who would hire me who were older than Frank Morgan would hire me, you know, for gigs. I'd play with, you know, I'm blanking out on his name right now, the bass player, Andy Simpkins.
Okay.
Would play. Harold Land, I'd play with. These people, and
that's my guy, Harold Land, man.
Yeah, you know, I'd play with him at the Parisian Room with Freddie, but then sometimes he'd call me for his own gigs, you know. And
did you ever play with Bobby Hutcherson?
Oh yeah, all the time.
Okay,
you know, Herbie Lewis, I played with a lot.
Oh yeah, Herbie. Yeah,
you know, Billy Higgins, the ultimate like mentor.
Yeah,
you know, you know, I learned it was like kind of like it takes a village to you know, raise a child was kind of the sensibility back then.
Yeah.
You know, now it takes $200,000 to raise a child in an institution.
Yeah.
Because that's how kids are learning now.
Yeah.
They go to the school, they get, you know, they transcribe solos and there's all these new techniques of how to scientifically and methodically learn how to play, and you know, so what you have is a lot of kids, what you have is a lot of kids who are very proficient on their instrument but are still maybe searching for their voice.
Yeah.
But that's not a slight on the kids that are coming out of these institutions, because human beings are still human beings, you know. This, you know, if there was Herbie Hancock in the 60s, there's Herbie Hancock now.
Yeah.
You know, and manifested in some 23-year-old kid, you know. Kids, humans are humans. If there's no reason why there can't be another Keith Jarrett, Keith Jarrett, but Keith Jarrett as relevant to today.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, I think since technology has encroached upon us so much, you know, there is it's a bit more challenging for young musicians to remain like human. Yeah. You know, and not focused on technical, but focused on emotion or your voice, you know, making a statement, you know.
Well, I guess we can say at the very least, though, it has created jobs for musicians, I guess, you know, teaching.
Teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it becomes like its own self-perpetuating, like, kind of monster, you know.
Yeah.
Which is what I always thought of, like, it's what I thought of at the IAJE. It's like you would see a lot of colleges represented, you know, and a lot of people teaching, and people would be handing cards and passing cards and, you know, saying, let's do lunch and doing all of this, you know, because, you know, to further the academic career, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and it seemed,
I always remember when Jimmy Heath told me, you know, he said, man, you know, actually, you know, college teaching was a blessing for him, because he said, man, before that, I never had insurance or anything, you know, until I got that gig, you know.
Well, yeah, there's that aspect of it. I mean, I'm just talking about what it is.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
I don't have a judgment on it. Shoot, if someone wants to teach and get security and they're raising a family and then you can send your kids to the college, you know, then more power to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But the effect on jazz, with music going, a jazz discipline going into the colleges and off of the streets, is what it is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, okay.
You have, like, a lot of really great players coming out of college, and you have, like, two gigs, you know. And they're $200,000 in debt.
Yeah.
You know, that's one aspect of it too.
Yeah. Okay. And once again, I'm talking with pianist, composer, arranger Billy Childs. And Billy, as we look, of course, in terms of the future, I know you're still performing. And I looked on your website, and it looks like you're going to be doing concerts for the rest of the year. You know, with your quartet, your trio, your jazz chamber ensemble. Are you working on any new recording project?
I'm meeting with a couple of producers and trying to figure out my next album. I have a couple of ideas,
okay,
you know, but they're kind of unclear in my head right now, so I don't want to say what they are, but because it'll come out as gibberish. But
all right.
But I'm meeting with a couple people in the next couple weeks.
Okay. Okay. And once again, I've been talking with pianist, composer Billy Childs. And Billy, I really do appreciate you getting back with me. I thought we were going to miss this. But you...
Oh, yeah, this is my fault, totally okay. My fault.
All right, that's all right, but we got it in. And I want to play, as we leave, I want to play another selection from your recording, Rebirth, and it's your composition, The Starry Night. Tell me a little bit about that composition.
That composition actually was my first Grammy nomination.
Okay.
I wrote it for the album Ivanhoe Rivers back in 90. I wrote it in 94, and we released the album in 95. And then I decided to redo it. It's kind of a complicated song, you know. It's a song that moves through a lot of different sections and has a lot of different time signature changes that have to be negotiated kind of, you know, as one smooth ride.
Yeah.
You know? So this group just really played it beautifully.
Well, in fact, I like this group that you have. Tell me how you say the bass player's last name.
Glavisnig.
Oh, I was saying it all wrong.
Oh, yeah, I know.
All right.
You say gla and then vish and then nig.
Okay.
Glavisnig.
Glavisnig. All right. Okay, and yeah. And once again, we've been talking with Billy Childs, and Billy, thanks again for, you know, calling me back, and I'm glad we got this in. Very interesting interview tonight, and we're going to leave with the selection, The Starry Night. Take care, man.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. If you're my first caller here at 256-372-5861, that's 256-372-5861. You can win a copy of the CD by Billy Childs. You're listening to it right now. We'd like to congratulate Mr. Howard Bank here, called and won himself a copy of the CD you're listening to right now. It's by pianist Billy Childs. It's called Rebirth on Return to the Source. Pianist Billy Childs, music from his latest recording, the 2017 release on Mac Avenue Records called Rebirth. Of course, as we said, won the Grammy Award for Best Jazz Instrumental Album. And we heard his composition, The Starry Night. And of course, you're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. Keep your dial here. We'll be back with more great jazz. But first, this message.
Hello, this is the maestro, Sean Patrick. Join me for Mellow Madness till midnight, 8 p.m. till 12 midnight, Tuesday through Saturday. We'll have fun, relaxation, and mellow music. We'll also have birthday tributes and oldies from the 50s through 2000. That's Mellow Madness till midnight, 8 p.m. till 12 midnight, Tuesday through Saturday on 90.9 FM.